I'll call the meeting to order and ask the clerk to take the roll.
Senators Leeson.
Here.
Elke. Triplett.
Here.
Representative Kretschmar.
Here.
Glassine.
Here.
Colmeen. Director Birch.
Here.
Mr. Brownshield. Mr. Krupp.
Present.
Mr. Johnston. Sheriff Laney.
Here.
Judge McEvers.
Present.
Justice Marion. Director Olson.
Here.
Dr. Ray.
Here.
Mr. Trenbeth.
Here.
And Chief Witt.
Here.
It's a quorum.
We do have a quorum. I'm sure that everybody has scrutinized the minutes of the last meeting that was mailed to you, and I'm looking for a motion. We have a motion to approve the minutes of the last meeting. Do I have a second?
Second.
And we have a second. All those, any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion approved. Well, that was easy. We're already down to Ms. Birch, who's going to give us her presentation at 4 minutes earlier than we had planned on.
Good morning, members of the commission. For the record, my name is Leanne Birch. I'm the director of the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. I was asked to provide an update on our state's good time law, or what is referred to in statute as our performance-based sentence reduction system, and what the DOCR's policy and procedures are on how PBSR is applied. And really what came to light is Chairman Leeson indicated that sometimes other states are, we look at other states and it might appear that we're behind the curve and what's really the situation going on in North Dakota. PBSR, performance-based sentence reduction, replaced the old good time law in 1991 when Chapter 1254.1 of the North Dakota Century Code was amended. I provided copies of the old law and the current law, and that's handouts 1 and 2. Our current PBSR law is a vast improvement over the old good time law. The old good time law was confusing and difficult to apply and often resulted in inmates sentenced to longer sentences actually serving less time than inmates sentenced to shorter periods of incarceration. As you can see, it was a graduated compilation that was very confusing. There was also no performance criteria tied to the awarding of good time. They just earned it under the law, depending on how much time they had to serve. Under the old law, because of the greater amount of good time granted to inmates, the impression was that of a revolving door at the state penitentiary. The current PBSR law requires inmates to meet performance criteria, such as participation in court-ordered or staff-recommended treatment and education programs. Inmates may earn up to 5 days of good time per month for each month of the sentence imposed. So for example, if they have a 1 year sentence, they're going to end up serving, if they get all of their good time, they're going to end up serving 10 months. However, inmates cannot be credited for any sentence reduction for time spent in custody prior to sentence and commitment, for time under supervised probation, or for any sentence where the incarceration time is 6 months or less. Inmates may also receive up to 2 days per month of meritorious conduct sentence reduction for outstanding performance or heroic acts, or as a special control and security measure as provided by penitentiary and department rules and upon written recommendation of a department multidisciplinary team. I've provided a copy of the DOCR's policy and procedure on how PBSR is applied. It's quite lengthy and detailed. The meritorious good time that I just talked about, however, is granted fairly rarely. Usually the one that probably about three times a year I get a request that comes up to my desk asking for meritorious sentence reduction for an inmate saving the life of another inmate, for example, Heimlich maneuver or assisting in a severe medical emergency. Although the flood effort, there was some meritorious good time because of the outstanding performance that the inmates at MRCC actually provided this summer. The application of PBSR was also impacted by the passage of the Truth in Sentencing Law passed into law in 1995. Offenders convicted of and sentenced to state prison must serve 85% of their sentence without benefit of parole. qualifying offenses are murder, manslaughter, aggravated assault, kidnapping, robbery, gross sexual imposition with the use of force or threat of the use of force or a weapon, burglary, and menacing or threatening the inhabitants or using a weapon during the commission of the offense. Conspiracy sentences are separated out from the actual act or accomplice. The question of whether North Dakota is behind the curve in awarding inmates credit for good behavior can be answered no. The purpose of good time, or PBSR, can be achieved with the current 5 days per month. PBSR provides an effective incentive for inmates to participate in correctional programming and abide by institutional rules. Overly aggressive or expansive good time can erode the public's confidence in the criminal justice system by viewing the prison as having a revolving door. PBSR is a back-end mechanism to impact the length of incarceration. A more proactive approach would be to address sentencing practices. If PBSR were increased, it is likely sentences would be lengthened as well to account for the increased good time. A comparison of the number of good time days awarded in various states cannot be accurately compared without examining each state's sentencing laws. In the 1990s, when the federal government was rewarding states with truth in sentencing grants, a number of states abolished their parole boards and adopted determinate sentencing. North Dakota has a discretionary parole law whereby parole decisions are completely at the discretion of the board. However, inmates subject to the 85% law are not eligible to meet the parole board. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Is there any questions for Ms. Birch? Hearing none, thank you. Now that we've all heard this, and we had some questions in the last meeting, and you've got information, is there any discussion on, or further discussion, I should say, on this topic? Are we that early in the morning? Well.
I want to ask Ms. Birch a question, if I may.
We have a question from Representative Meyer.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Birch, about what percent of the people who are incarcerated take advantage of this good time or they're qualify for it?
Sorry, my mic's not on. But if they're not participating, then their good time stops until they come into compliance with programming. And the other thing is, for disciplinary measures, for a serious sanction, we can take away good time as well. But all of them earn it except those that I referenced. If you have a sentence shorter than 6 months, you can't earn it. And the 85%ers obviously aren't impacted by the good time because they have to serve 85% of their sentence.
Thank you.
They don't start getting that until they start, until they get through the preliminary things and they're starting to take care of all of the areas that you want them to participate in.
Senator Leeson, it actually starts accruing from the day they'll start getting the good time, other than the ones that I told you about, will start getting it the day they step into the penitentiary, unless there's reason for them not to get it. Because it's credited. If they're in compliance, they'll earn it.
But one of them would be if they did not with their program, then
example, or if they were offered a job and they didn't take the job, they're not in compliance with their work requirements. Okay. Then they won't get it.
Further questions? Oh, Mr. Trimbeth.
Took you a while to recognize me. Mr. Chairman, just a general comment. With respect to the correction systems in the state, it doesn't strike me as a proper examination for this committee to look at the good time structure there, because I think that's been looked at pretty closely over the course of time, and the legislature's done what it I think is required to make or to allow that system to function correctly and allow Ms. Birch to keep her students in line. The problem was, and maybe continues to be, although I haven't done a study of this, the problem was the mandatory minimum situation, where there for a time the legislature was bent on taking the power of the judges out of their hands by prescribing mandatory minimums in legislation, which led to, in my opinion, an overcrowding of our penitentiary system with people that maybe didn't belong there, if the judge had appropriate discretion. It also led to prosecutors and defense counsel coming to agreement on lesser charges in order to avoid a mandatory minimum and get a better sentence. I think, without having done any sort of inquiry, let alone statistical inquiry, that problem has been somewhat at least alleviated. But I don't think the good time situation is a problem, and Leanne, you may disagree, you may have some plans for that, but just a general comment.
Ms. Birch?
No, the good time law, the way it's structured now, works very, very well. And talking to one of our employees who's been there through the old good time law now, this is a vast improvement, and it works very, very well. The other concern I would have about changing the good time law is we're getting to the point where now we have very, very few inmates that are under the old good time law. That's a good thing, because it's disconcerting to have some who might have sentenced to 30 years, they're going to end up serving 20 under the old good time law, and you have someone that was sentenced to 30 and they're going to sentence to, you know, so their sentence is significantly longer. So it's nice to have a consistent good time law applied across the board, and it works very well.
Thank you. Any further questions or comments on the good time? Hearing none, we're going to go right forward and ask our legislative staff to enlighten us about a bill draft.
All right, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, there should be a draft sitting in front of you, the one draft that the only other handout that we had, so I hope it's under your agenda. At the last meeting, there was discussion about trying to find a way to provide temporary restricted licenses or other options that might be available to allow some of the people who have driving under suspension penalties to obtain temporary driving privileges if under certain conditions. The representatives of the Department of Transportation, who probably aren't here because we're a little ahead of schedule, sent out basically a survey or a request to a number of judges and I believe prosecutors, Mr. Croft was on the list, sort of a working group to help them develop some ideas to forward on to our office to put into a bill draft. What we tried to do was take some of those suggestions, the ones that seemed to be most uniformly accepted probably by the people that were submitting the comments, and put them into this draft. So what we have done is prepared a draft of basically amending three existing sections under the law. The first section is a section that deals with the additional penalties for violating restrictions in a restricted license. And on lines 15 and 16, there was language that would prohibit the director of DOT from issuing a restricted license for the extended period of suspension imposed under this section in basically all cases. The intent of removing that language is just to provide some flexibility that could come into play as a result of what I think we believed were cases where there were suspensions on top of suspensions, so that this continually piling up of suspensions would lead to extreme amount of time where there would be no license option, and it was our intent, and we haven't heard any comments from DOT after we sent them an original draft to where they're at with this, but the intent was to at least provide the director some flexibility. It's just taking out the prohibition that the director can't issue any temporary restricted license. So the idea of Section 1 is to provide some flexibility. Section 2, if you go on to page 2, the change is a new subsection 3, and there was a suggestion submitted by, I believe, someone, might have been a clerk of court from Fargo, Sherry Clark, judges, is she clerk of court, or, not sure, okay, all right. Didn't have the name right. Okay, anyway, the suggestion was, in some cases, as I understood the suggestion, to be that if a person is under suspension, probably for maybe failure to appear and not responding to the notices, that they have the opportunity to re-obtain their license rather easily, to pay the reinstatement fee, to take care of the outstanding issues. And the suggestion was that if the person could obtain their license within 20 days after the offense, then the court would dismiss the charge for driving under suspension. And there would have to be satisfactory evidence of the reinstatement. And it's simple option here for a court to, not actually the court would dismiss, be required to dismiss the charge if the license is reinstated within those 20 days and proof is submitted. Section 3 gets...
Mr. Chairman, John, I'm sorry if I could interrupt for a second. One of the situations, and probably the more common situation that this last amendment would address, is a situation where a person who has lost their license under 390801 and is eligible for reinstatement but hasn't reinstated, and gets stopped sometime and is without a license and it has been revoked or suspended because of a violation of 390801. Now, we can argue whether or not that suspension is continued and can be described as such, but that's the way the courts have treated it, and this would allow that person, even though he or she has been eligible for a license, to go in and get one and then not suffer the penalty that's prescribed for having driven without a license, having previously been suspended under 390801. You said it more clearly, John, but I think that's...
Mr. Chairman, I think that Mr. Cranmuth has brought a situation out that was more clear than what I explained. One of the situations, and I'll tell you a personal note and thank Chief Witt as well, but in January I was pulled over on the way to work for coasting through a stop sign, and the officer cut me a break when he had something more important to do at the moment, so the citation was entered into the system, but he was going to withdraw it, and I'd forgotten about it because nothing happened, but it was into the system, and I got a letter from Mr. Jackson saying that my license was going to be suspended for failure to appear. And I think this would have applied to me had I not responded to the letter and inquired with Chief Witt as to if that was a situation too. So I kind of struck home with me on that one a little bit there too. Section 3 is the section of temporary restricted licenses. We've added some new language on starting on about line 17, makes a change there. One is that we reduce the period under which a person would have had to stay offense free from 2 years to 1 year before they apply for a temporary restricted license. And we put in some additional language on the conditions or the requirements of the application, proof of financial responsibility, and if the person was required to have a addiction treatment program, and continuing addiction treatment program, they'd have to provide proof of compliance of attendance, or if they were participating in a drug court or some other court-ordered sobriety program, that they would have a recommendation from the court to from the district court to the DOT, saying that this person would be a candidate for a temporary restricted license. Under those conditions, the director could issue or hold a hearing and may require the applicant to submit proof of participation in a driver training course that would be approved by the director. The director has some latitude also in deciding the conditions of the license, and the new subsection 6 on page 4, lines 9 through 18, states that in addition to some other restrictions that the director already has under statute, that they can, the director can restrict the offender to driving during the normal working hours, and also to go to licensed addiction treatment programs or treatment programs that are ordered by the court, or to use the driving privileges basically to, you know, get groceries or do things that wouldn't deprive them of the medical or nutritional or educational needs of the offender or an immediate family member. And this is language that we essentially stole from Minnesota's law that has those conditions or those additional options beyond just the normal working hours. So it's a bit of an expansion of the existing law, in that we spell out those additional reasons that the person may be authorized to drive. That, Mr. Chairman, is what we believe covered the suggestions that came in from the working group or the task force that the DOT solicited information from, and tried to incorporate those into some options for you to look at. And as I said, we didn't hear any comments yet from DOT. Some of the details of the actual procedure that's followed and some of the policies that are used were not totally familiar with, and I expect the DOT people might have some comments about whether we did it right or if there are better options or better ways to do it, what we attempted to do.
So we have the DOT here right now, huh? Hop up to the mic here.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
Members of the Commission. I'm Glenn Jackson, the Director of the Driver's License Division at the DOT, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to present information to you today. The DOT reviewed the proposed changes to statute and our policies as they impact the availability to issue a temporary restricted license with respect to the DUS issue. In regards to the proposed changes in statute, we agree with them with two minor changes, and that would be on page 2, line 29. There's a subsection you refer to 4. It should be 4 instead of 3 because you inserted a new subsection 3. And another concern we had was on page 4, line 10. In reading this, we interpret this to mean that the temporary license could be used outside of normal working hours to meet the needs listed in 11 through 15. However, we would ask that you really look at that language and make sure the phrasing is such that it wouldn't be misinterpreted, that it really does mean they can do these other things outside of normal working hours. Just a minor point. The Division Policy S1, which is our policy for issuing a TRL, may also be modified. Currently, a TRL is valid only for 12 hours a day. We could remove this time restraint and make it reflect the driver's needs versus certain hours in the day. Currently, an applicant that has 4 or more moving traffic violations on record for the previous 12 months, or 12 or more traffic violations for the previous 36, is ineligible. We could remove the 4 or more within 12, but make it 12 within 36 by making them moving traffic violations. Currently, an applicant that has 2 or more criminal offenses, implied consent convictions resulting from separate incidences within 36 months, is ineligible. We could modify this to specify 2 or more criminal traffic violate or convictions or implied consent convictions within the previous 36 months. And currently, the list of criminal traffic convictions includes DUS. We could remove DUS from consideration as a conviction that would prevent a TRL. All these recommendations, potential modifications, do have an impact. By removing the 12-hour-a-day driving time limit, we open the TRL up as a full-time driving license, restricted only to the items the person needs to drive to. And by granting a TRL to an individual who has been convicted of DUS, we do set a precedent that the DUS may not be as serious of an offense as intended. For these reasons, we would like to hear your perspective on these ideas before we reach a decision and anything is implemented to ensure we are meeting the level of mitigation the law is intended to have as a means to prevent offenses from occurring and as a tool in managing this behavior. Before I would take any questions, I would also add, we were asked to take a look at the certified mail cost at the last meeting, and after reviewing that, it would cost us roughly $1 million every biennium to conduct a certified mail for all of our mailings that go out reference suspensions and revocations and cancellations.
$1 million?
Yes, sir. I have the calculations here if you'd like to see it, sir. And I would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Mr. Croft.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Jackson, if you take the 12-hour time restriction out, you would just do it on a case-by-case basis, or it would just be 24 hours a day?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Croft, that we don't know. Would it be advisable to do away with the 12-hour limit, period? Would it be advisable to do away with it based upon the needs of the individual? If they have a, for example, if they have a job in the morning and then they have a job in the evening, so that their requirements are such that the 12-hour window would not work for them, should we make an exception in that case? Or should we do away with the 12-hour limitation? We don't know.
Mr. Chairman,
I think it would be ill-advised for this committee to give advice to the DOT on what their policies ought to be.
I think you're absolutely right. Well, anything we do here with related to the to this bill, even if we pass this bill through, it still goes in front of the legislature and it'll be scrutinized to the limit there. So, but I think if we can, if there's any areas in here that we think we can clean up now before it gets down there, it might be well worth it. Well, the chief, what do you think of this? You're sitting there thinking.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for asking, Mr. Chairman. I guess before I make my other comments, just kind of preface my remarks by relying back to my working days as a street policeman, as I'm sure Sheriff Laney and you yourself. Just a few years ago, I had some experience, but when it comes to driving under suspension, you know, we just don't have checkpoints out there that we're checking to see if people have a license or if it's under suspended. There is a large number of people whose license under suspension, and we come across those people because they consistently continue to violate traffic laws. It just always amazed me when I would stop somebody for speeding or running a red light or doing something really outrageous at times with their car, they'd be under suspension. And then they'd want a break, And it's like, well, your license is already under suspension. I would think that if you know your license is suspended, you would be following the laws so that you're not coming to the attention of the police department. But those people, whatever it is, extremely poor judgment or scoff laws, whatever it is, they continue to drive. So we do have some unsafe drivers out there whose licenses should be suspended and they should not be driving. That being said, I understand that there are folks out there that, for whatever unfortunate circumstance, they had too much to drink. They're kind of a one-time person that got their license suspended. So I think there should be a window of, sufficient window of opportunity to allow those folks to get their licenses back. So, you know, again, I'm somewhat opposed to some of these changes, but again, somewhat understand them. And that being said, with the revision on page 2, number 3, it says a court shall dismiss, where I think maybe more appropriately it should maybe be may dismiss a charge to allow the judge some discretion there. And the other thing is, I can tell you on page 4, that subsection 3, sitting here today, I understand what to use as necessary to prevent the substantial deprivation and so forth and so on, what the intent of that means, but I'll tell you, at 3 o'clock in the morning, it's going to mean one thing to a police officer, and it's going to mean a significantly different thing to the person that's been caught driving. And, you know, my 3-year-old really likes Kool-Aid, and we're out of Kool-Aid in the house, so I needed to run down to the store and get some. So that, to me, as a parent with a screaming 3-year-old, may be a substantial deprivation, but is that really what we're trying to allow them to drive for? So it really is subject to interpretation, which ultimately is probably going to be decided in a court of law. And my police officers are going to be sitting in court when they don't necessarily need to be trying to sort things like this out, because currently my experience has been it's hard enough with a work permit to determine should this person be driving legitimately because they're going to and from and work, or are they taking the scenic route from home to work, or what are they doing driving at this time? And now we throw all these other conditions in, I can just see some potential for problems down the road. So.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, I couldn't have said it any better myself. I fully agree with them. I remember many a night at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you're exactly right, Chief. You'd be walk up to the car to hand you, well, I don't have a license, I'm suspended, when you're driving like the biggest idiot in town. And, you would never, had they driven like a normal human being, you would never even have your attention drawn to them in the first place, and now you know why their license was suspended. So, this is a double-edged sword with this, because I definitely see where you're trying to go with this, and the fact that, and I can't remember the number right now, just in Cass County alone, how many thousands of drivers are suspended right now? Do you have that? It's like 7,000 or something like that, just in Cass County. So it's kind of a vicious cycle, because when some, they can never get out of that cycle. Now, you can't stop stupid members that they're going to be terminally suspended because they just can't drive. They're the ones that you're talking about. But there are also the ones that, just by the vicious, they need to support their families, they need to go to work, they need to try to get out of that cycle of how they're suspended, and then they make a mistake, and then they get resuspended, and then it's even longer. And so I definitely understand what you're trying to capture here, and I certainly respect that. I also agree with the chief, though. It's very hard at those situations that where we're trying to decipher who's legitimately suspended and who's legitimately not, and you have this out, but you're fully suspended, but you have this. It's going to be hard for your average officer or deputy on the street to try to sort that out. But so I'm right where the chief is at on this. On kind of some mixed feelings, but we've also had these conversations right in my own shop where this vicious cycle's got to quit, because it's just we can't ever get some of these people out of that cycle, and they can't ever drive again, and that's not right either. So I don't know that I have an answer, but it looks like you're certainly trying.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lane, I think that's the dilemma. The dilemma is we have some individuals who get a DUS because they're suspended. That's the only reason now. They were driving suspended, and they have to drive. They live out of town. They have to get to work. They have to do certain things. There may be a single individual that has no other alternatives, and they get suspended again and again and again and again. And so finally it gets to the point they're suspended until 2240. And there's no way they'll ever be able to drive with any level of legitimacy. So that's what we're trying to address. Only the DUS because of a DUS, not because of a DUI, not because of anything else or criminal traffic convictions, but just because of the individuals that get caught in that particular rat race.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chairman, you know, and I guess I'm one of those that, you know, especially in this committee, we're supposed to be looking at alternatives to things that happen, you're right, we can't make it so black and white, because we're kind of that victim of, if you keep doing what you've always done, you're going to get the same results, but we're exactly in that, and so I guess, are there some concerns here? Definitely. At the same time, we have thousands out there that aren't going to get it back, and they're just, we've got to try something different. So I, you know, it can't hurt to try.
And I think one of the things that came up at the last meeting, and anyway, it did to me, being an old cop, and I worked the same hours that everybody else did. I knew people that were under suspension. If I met them on the street, am I supposed to look the other way? And I look the other way, and they go down the street and kill one of the neighbor's daughters. Who's at fault here? So let's take law enforcement, say, they have to do their jobs. It's not them that's committing the violation. And I think that's a lot of times that people feel. And it's not them that's doing the violation. It's the person that's getting in that car. And I don't care who it is. They have to be someplace. They should have some friends, some relatives, or somebody else to take them. Let's not put the burden on the public for their stupidities. So now I'll get off my soapbox.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Triplett, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I guess I'd just like to respond to a couple of the comments that have previously been made, and I appreciate Director Jackson's reference that we're only talking about suspensions because of previous suspensions. You know, the two descriptions that both of our law enforcement officers just made are about basically new driving violations while someone was suspended. You know, if you come across someone who is speeding or running a red light, I mean, you certainly can stop them and charge them with what their new violations are, and they should be appropriately, you know, penalized for that. But if you stop somebody just because you recognize their license plate as being somebody who's suspended, which does happen in especially the rural parts of our state where, you know, law enforcement just kind of knows everybody who lives in the small counties, or at least before the oil development they did, and they just keep stopping somebody because they're a known person and a known suspended driver. Or if you stop somebody for, you know, something that's non-criminal, like, you know, having a light out or something, and, you know, you just stop them to point out that they have, you know, that they have a light burned out, and then you find out that they're driving under suspension. And so, I guess, from my perspective, those are the kinds of things that we're trying to get past here. We're not trying to give people licenses whose driving is so awful that they ought not to have licenses. We're trying to get past the notion of continually penalizing somebody for one behavior in the distant past that just keeps building on itself because the fact that they can't get their license back. So I don't think we're trying to hinder or harness law enforcement from keeping, you know, from keeping the public safety.
Judge.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question for Mr. Jackson, and that's you indicated you agreed in general with this bill draft, but I'm concerned on page 2.
It is on.
I'll hold a little closer. I'm concerned a little bit with the line 16 through 19, and more specifically the amount of time within which the license would have to be instated being 20 days. And I'm wondering if a defendant will have time. They get pulled over, they get cited, there has to be a court appearance scheduled, and they have to be reinstated within 20 days of the date of the offense. Is 20 days an adequate amount of time in general for someone to get their license reinstated?
Mr. Chairman, Judge McEvers, in general terms, no. When someone is made aware of a suspension, or someone is made aware of an issue with their driving privileges, by the time the process goes through, it may take more than 20 days, but if it is a very simple issue for them to come in and just pay a reinstatement fee or do something quickly, then 20 days would be sufficient. So there's a lot of variables in that.
Mr. Chairman, if I could ask another question.
Continue.
And part of my concern is that depending on the jurisdiction, they might not even be scheduled in court within that 20 days. And so if they have to be reinstated within 20 days of the offense, there might be an impossibility there. So the amount of time is my concern.
Mr. Krupp.
Mr. Jackson, the way I read that, they have to get it reinstated within 20 days, and then they're good. It doesn't matter when they show up in court. Court can be 30 days, 40 days out. Am I correct?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Krupp, I think that would depend on interpretation, but it could be interpreted either way. So even though it says the court shall dismiss a charge, them getting their license reinstated within 20 days could be interpreted either way, I think.
Further questions? Senator, I'm sorry, Mr.
No need to be sorry, Senator. Those were grand days.
For you.
In response to the last comment, that would certainly be possible, but it would create another problem, of course, and that's the person that gets his license back on the 22nd day and goes to court on the 30th day, and the judge says, "Can't help it, got to take the license away." So there may be some word, some ways of, well, undoubtedly, there are some ways of clarifying this language. I think the basic concept is good. I like Chief Witt's suggestion that it become a precatory rather than a mandatory action. But I think, you know, we're reaching the goal, as we've discussed before.
Further questions or comments? Have you got anything more?
No, sir.
Mr. Chairman, what?
Sheriff, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Jackson, one last question is, looking at, on page four, starting in line nine, where it starts talking to restrictions, you know, if they have a suspended license and they're supposed to attend their treatments and all that, is that basically under any type of suspension? So if you've been arrested for DUI, drugs, DUI, alcohol, you're suspended for your, you know, your 90 days, or your, if you refused, your 1 year, and now, but you now are going to treatment, does that mean you're also, you're under suspension from the courts, but now you'll get a temporary permit, outside the work permit, to go to, you can go to work during the day, and then if you have your treatment later that night, you can also drive to your treatment as well? And then how is law, your officer on the street or your deputy on the street, how do they acknowledge that? Because we can't call the treatment facilities, they can't tell us they're even coming there. So how do we know that we're not, you know, hey, I'm on my way to my treatment facility and they're on their way to the bar? Because if we call any of the counseling services, they won't even tell us if they're registered there because of HIPAA. So where do, I mean, again, put our street hats back on, the realities of good intentions, I'm wondering where we fall into that.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Blaney, if someone has issued a temporary restricted license, it states on there what their requirements are. And if they have one, and if they're driving within currently the time limits that are defined, and if they say they're going to treatment, since that is currently defined as part of the life management issues that we issue at this time, then you would have to assume that because they're within their valid driving window, that they are driving for a valid purpose.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, go ahead.
Chief Witt.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Jackson, just a question on 390642, the penalty for driving while suspended or revoked. Now, that section doesn't specifically apply only to those suspensions for 390801 or DUI. This would be any, if a person's license was suspended for any reason, accumulation of points or DUI. So then, in effect, if they were somewhat astute in legal issues in number three, if they got a 30-day suspension, they would understand that basically now their suspension is 10 days, or quite likely that. After, on day 11, they could start driving knowing that, hey, I'm going to get my license back. If they would be eligible, that they understand that I can start driving, and if I get suspension, I can just simply go to court once my, show my license has been reinstated. And so wouldn't we, in somewhat in effect, possibly be shortening up period of suspension?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Witt, I would prefer to look at each individual situation and try and look at the law in relation to it rather than make a general statement, but there are always various and interesting ways to look at how the statutes combine that enable people to do certain things.
Okay, thank you.
You got out of that one pretty easy. Any further questions or comments?
Mr. Chairman?
I didn't see, oh, Senator Driplett.
Hiding over here, in plain view. I have a follow-up regarding the conversation between Mr. Jackson and Judge McEvers. I think I heard you agreeing that the 20 days might be difficult or an impossibility sometimes under some circumstances. Do you have a number of days that we might substitute that would not be an impossibility or difficult?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Driplett, we assume that from the time we send out a notification to someone that within 72 hours they've been notified. But we won't send that out for many things until we receive a conviction from the court. So to say 20 days from the time of suspension, the suspension wouldn't occur until the conviction has arrived. So the way it's worded and what we're trying to do, the intent, I believe, is very good. But I think we do need to look at how it's being phrased and how it's being developed as a tool to use. As far as a number of days, we'd really have to just look at that and come up with a better number of it.
Okay. Or maybe days that relate to something other than the offense, 20 days from some other starting point. I think we can't just leave this hanging that there's a problem, but do you have a suggestion for us, or would you like to think about it and get back to council?
Well, I don't have a suggestion because we operate on convictions. We get notified of convictions in the system. We don't get notified of a traffic offense has occurred. So the underlying idea that someone is going to be suspended based on an offense, if by the word offense you mean the conviction for the offense, then we've already been notified of the conviction, so that kind of brings into play, could the court do something if it's within 20 days of an offense before it goes to the court? If it's after 20 days of conviction, that might be a different process. If someone has stopped for DUS, we don't know that. We only know when a conviction for DUS comes to us.
Getting back to the money. Tell me again about this $1 million. Where is that? That's still stuck here with me.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll provide this to you. It costs $6.46 to send one certified letter. We average 220 a day. That's $1,400 a day, average. In a year, that's $355,000 just for the certified letter, or $710,000 in a biennium. In order to manage this process, it takes about 5 minutes to prepare that certified letter, to get everything ready, to get it in the envelope and get it all done. And then when it comes back, we have to then get that green card, we have to scan it, image it in the system, we have to document that we received it. It's going to take about 3 minutes, we think, to process the return. That's 8 minutes per item. At 8 minutes, that's about 18 and a half minutes, or 18 hours for sending them out, 11 hours for getting them back. You're looking at about 3.5 FTE per day to process the certified mail. And at a cost for a normal licensing clerk, you're looking at about $700-ish a day in staff time. So staffing would cost you $180,000 a year, or about $360,000 a biennium, which comes up to $1 million. So certified mail would be costly, and it would not be a guarantee that the information that was sent was received, because if they just don't accept getting the certified mail, it comes back and it wasn't received.
Okay. Further questions? No, thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else here that would like to speak on this subject? If not, is there any other comments from the committee on this? Judge, did you have your hand up?
I didn't, but I was thinking, so you must have called on me by intuition. I was trying to think of a way to address Senator Triplett's question. Perhaps if, and I'm just thinking on the fly, if it was a number of days from the date of their first appearance in court, because then my issue is, and Mr. Cruff here and I had a little side conversation, he's making an assumption that perhaps the officer is going to advise them that if they get their license back within 20 days, this would get dismissed. I don't make assumptions that an officer is going to tell people how to get their driver's license back, but perhaps the prosecutor would, because they don't want to have to try another DUS case, and, or perhaps the judge could. And so I'm thinking if it was within a number of days from their first appearance, so that they have an opportunity for somebody to tell them that if you get your license reinstated, this charge could get dismissed. That is just an off-the-cuff comment, and but I do think that the 20 days in most instances isn't going to be enough, and we're going to have the issue that Mr. Trenbeth indicated, that people will come in 22 days and 24 days after, and why are they getting different treatment than someone who happened to have their court appearance scheduled faster, and so somebody told them, so they were able to get it done within the 20 days.
Thank you. Any further comments? Okay, we'll put this one to rest for right now, and we'll go on to the next.
Chairman?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Are we going to discuss this later in the meeting, or should we make some suggestions or recommendations?
If you got some suggestions or recommendations, why don't we do them right now?
Yeah, well, I think what Judge McEvers just said makes a huge amount of sense to me. I mean, it certainly makes more sense than what's in there right now. So unless someone comes up with a better idea, I guess I would request that we have a redraft that includes that. And then that we also have a redraft that includes a couple of the other, the change that Director Jackson referenced. Last year, the simple technical correction on page 30 of page 2, changing a 3 to a 4, and I like the notion of a little bit of judicial discretion on page 2, line 3, that Chief Witt suggested, where we change the shall to may. So I guess those three things I would suggest that we have written into a subsequent draft for our consideration.
Okay. We'll get that done, and we'll bring it up again at the next meeting. Representative Klasner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 4, the expansion of the things that you could do, in section 3, there was some talk about this, if you're going out to get Kool-Aid, that sort of thing, but it seems to me that educational and nutritional needs are things that could be taken care of during the normal working day or planned for. As if you have to go somewhere educationally, it's an ongoing issue. It's not. So I wonder if we couldn't limit that to emergency thing. I mean, somebody's bleeding, you get them to the hospital. I don't care if you're under suspension or not, you know. But if we just limit it to emergency items, or medical certainly seems to me. But the other things are non-recurring, or they should be planned for during a normal time, to get somebody else to drive you to, if you're going to school or you're going somewhere. I could see limiting that one. We certainly want to provide for them to get to a licensed addiction treatment in Section 2. I mean, that's a legitimate thing. We want them doing that. So I could see limiting it to emergency in subsection 3 there. And in terms of an officer stopping them and them arguing, I mean, ultimately, if they say, I have an emergency, and the officer says, doesn't sound like an emergency to me, then they cite them, then they would go to court, right? And you would have to, it would be decided by somebody saying, well, is this an emergency situation or not? So anyway, I could see limiting it to either medical or other or emergency in subsection 3.
Is there any other comments on Representative Glassheim's thoughts of changing that area? Senator Triplett.
I always hate to get into an argument with my dear friend, Representative Glassheim. But we do sometimes. I just think that it's his point is kind of covered in the way the language is written, where it says to use as necessary to prevent the substantial deprivation of educational, medical, or nutritional needs. I mean, I think the as necessary and substantial deprivation, you know, do put some limitations on it in a way that suggests that, the Kool-Aid example would not fly. And the bleeding example would clearly fly. So, you know, I just don't think that, I mean, I don't know how the word emergency is better or worse than substantial deprivation, but I guess personally I would like it to be something a little looser than emergency, and so I kind of like that phrasing myself.
I'll tell you that, Senator Triplett, I agree with you. I think that if we're going to change it, and it's not always that we agree, because we sat on the same committee in the Senate, but we agree most of the time. But I do agree with Senator Triplett on that. I think that if we're going to put it through, let's do it so it's going to be beneficial to everybody. Thank you. We don't have to worry about Representative Glassine's comment now. He said he withdrew. Anybody else got any suggestions that we change this? And we'll talk again about it the next session, the next committee. Okay? We'll close that portion then, and we'll go into the 1051, and that's representative from Bismarck Transitional Center.
Senator Leeson, members, thank you for allowing us to present this morning. My name is Kevin Arthaud. I'm the administrator of the Bismarck Transition Center. Warren Emmer is also an employee of the Bismarck Transition Center. He's going to be handing out some flyers for you to look at.
Before you start, I think it's Mr. Emmer just handed me something, and this is not really fair, because he handed me something with my picture in here of 1963. Thank you, Warren.
Senator, I'd like to take some time this morning to talk about the Bismarck Transition Center. Some or most in this room are probably aware of its purpose, but I would like to explain briefly about what we do. The Bismarck Transition Center is owned and managed by CCCS Incorporated. It's a corporation headquartered out of Butte, Montana. The Bismarck Transition Center is one of 11 sites. We provide multiple services, both to adults, males and females, and we have two sites that also manage youthful offenders with contracts through the federal government. The Bismarck Transition Center was opened in August of 2002. We are a center for male offenders, although I should add we do have 8 female beds, and those beds are filled primarily with city-county inmates and a few federal pretrial. But the bulk of the female beds are within the Bismarck-Mandan area. We expanded in June of 2006 to house 160 offenders. Right now we have contracts with the North Dakota Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, Burley County, Morton County, the City of Bismarck, and with the U.S. Federal Pretrial Services. We are an American Correctional Association accredited site. We passed our last audit last year with a 98% rating. The Bismarck Transition Center is a unique public and private partnership. The Transition Center is privately owned by Montana investors. The treatment programming, I'm going to ask Amy Ruff, licensed addiction counselor supervisor, to go more in depth on those issues. All of our treatment programming we offer is cognitive behavioral based. On those lines, we have been partnering with the DOC to get the necessary training and offer the same type of programming so that it's more of a seamless transition from the prison setting to the Bismarck Transition Center. The programs we currently offer are cognitive behavioral treatment, which is a Texas Christian University model, Thinking for a Change, which is a University of Cincinnati model, Advanced Practice Thinking for a Change, Level 2.1 Intensive Outpatient Programming, that's drug and alcohol programming, Level 1 Aftercare. We offer parenting skills and family systems on a case-by-case basis. Those are more of one-on-one types of issues between the residents we house and their case manager. We employ 52 staff. So that being said about the Bismarck Transition Center, I would want to jump back that the CCCS Incorporated has grown from a handful of staff back in 1983 when they first opened to now they're over 600 employees. So they've grown substantially. Like I mentioned earlier, the headquarters is in Butte, Montana. It's governed by a non-compensated board, many of whom have been there from day one. The corporation provides services for local, state, and federal agencies.
Do you take people on court orders then also?
Meaning they've been sentenced from the court?
They've been sentenced by the court to the Department of Corrections, for instance, and the Department of Corrections sends them to you. Is that the proper way of doing it?
Senator, yes, that's correct. We get the referrals from DOCNR, and that would be whether somebody who is still on inmate status may be referred to do the last couple, three, 4 months of their sentence, and then they would either get out or they would parole to us, those types of things. We also...
You don't have anybody that's still incarcerated, though, that's coming to you, is that right? You're coming on a parole basis and they would come to you?
Senator, no, we actually do have inmates who come to us who are still on inmate status.
Okay.
I believe we are contracted for 44 of those beds. Director Birch, if... Okay, 44 beds typically is what the DOC contracts for. And the bulk of those folks are, again, on close to their release date. We do not accept people who are violent, who are convicted of types of crimes they have to register as sex offenders. We do not accept those clients either. Typically, it's people who have been incarcerated for a while and they need a period to transition rather than just opening the door and they walk out. So we're there to help those people too. Some of the things that we do, we require residents to work while they're there. They do have a portion of the room and board they have to pay for. We require that they save a portion of all monies they earn for their discharge. We also require them to pay towards fines and fees and those types of things. And after they've paid those things, then you know, whatever monies are left over, there's a budget process too, where the case managers have to approve weekly spending. It's also an effort to get them to learn how to manage money. A lot of folks haven't had a checkbook even. So those are
some of these people that are working off campus, is that right?
Correct. All of them, well, I shouldn't say all of them, but most of them do. About three-fourths of the residents we have work in the Bismarck-Mandan area. Right now, the construction season is going full swing, and those companies employ a lot of our folks. We also, the companies around town would be like restaurants, those types of things. I can't think of many restaurants in Bismarck where some of our residents don't work. So they are working in the Bismarck-Mandan area, and our hopes are that when they are discharged from us, that they have enough money in their accounts to get an apartment, those types of things, and that they continue to keep that job. So the theory is if people have a job and are employed, that's going to help them, so they may not come back.
Do you keep track of these people after they get out to see if the treatment that you're giving them and the help that you're giving them has kept them out of trouble, or can you give us any ideas of some people that went through your program and is now out in the field, or out in the real world working? Do you keep track of them to see if they're in trouble or anything, to give us some kind of a idea that what you did for them was worthwhile?
Senator, we do not track those folks. The DOCNR does track at the 1, 2, and 3-year mark if someone has done a new crime or has been sent back to prison, those types of things. Periodically, you know, the parole officers, we're in contact with the parole officers frequently. We hear from time to time how people are doing, or if they end up coming back to us because they've been in doing some things that they probably shouldn't have been doing while they're on probationary status.
Okay. Anybody have any questions?
Senator, at this time, could I have Ms. Ruff step up and talk about some of our treatment programming?
Sure, that'd be good.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Amy Ruff. I'm the clinical supervisor of programming at the Bismarck Transition Center.
Hold the mic down a little bit for you. It moves.
40. It'll be short enough for Warren when he comes up.
Oh.
Sorry. I'm the clinical supervisor of programming at the Bismarck Transition Center, and I guess what I'm here to speak to is the purpose of, you know, this meeting and this group of people is to talk about alternatives to incarceration. And sometimes we have to think out of the box in how we do that. I'm here to talk in reference to how Bismarck Transition Center does that, primarily two ways, and it's in the programming that we provide to the offenders. We've been very lucky to work with the North Dakota Department of Corrections, who's been very progressive in the fact that they are about rehabilitation. They put a strong emphasis on the programming that is provided not only while they're in their three primary facilities, but while they're in their contract agencies also. That includes the Bismarck Transition Center Incorporated, the rest of the contract facilities throughout the state. One of the strong role models that they provided us was getting into evidence-based practices and what exactly does work with offenders to reduce that recidivism. That is one of the goals of the Department of Corrections, and therefore we're a contract agency, and that is one of our goals, is also to reduce recidivism. Strongly founded in cognitive theory-based programming and skills practicing. The other way we act as a diversion away from incarceration is through the Assessment Center, which was a RFP that was put out by the Department of Corrections, and Bismarck responded to. The Assessment Center at the Bismarck Transition Center has been up and running for 4 years, I believe. On average, we have about 120 people who are on probation, occasionally on parole, come through our Assessment Center, and its whole purpose is to divert people away from being incarcerated within the penitentiary system. It is a 60-day stay within the Bismarck Transition Center, and during the first 3 to 4 weeks of that, we are doing nothing but gathering collateral information from different human service centers or private mental health or addiction services throughout the state. We are watching their behavior, watching their interactions, and then at about the halfway mark, we have a clinical staffing that is definitely multidisciplinary in nature, in that we have their parole probation officers involved, sometimes their primary counselors from their home communities involved. Our staff obviously are involved, and we have a representative from the North Dakota Department of Corrections that's involved in that meeting. And as a team, we come up with recommendations for that particular offender with the main goal of, do this so you don't get incarcerated. So the Bismarck Transition Center as a whole, I would say how we help to reduce people getting incarcerated is through diversionary programs like that, as well as the programming that we offer in and of itself.
Is there any questions? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll pull the microphone down a little bit so Warren can talk.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Kevin, could you hand that up for me? Just for the record, my name is Warren Emmer. I work for CCCS Incorporated, as they affectionately call me, the part-time guy. I do special projects, which usually means anything the CEO calls me at about 8 at night and says, hey, Warren, I need you to start working on this. And so I want to talk to you about two of those projects, but as Kevin is handing out the material, let me give a little more description to what I handed out to the chairman. I'm one of these guys that go to auctions all the time, and I found a box of books, and sometimes I'll pay $2 for a box of books. I think I paid a lot more for that magazine than that, Stan.
You're not getting the money back.
Yeah, I know. But anyway, and I took them home, put them in our basement, and then we had a flood last summer, and I carried the stuff out to a shell area that was safe from the flood, and then as I was putting things back in house, I said, I need to look through these boxes because I don't need everything that to go back in the basement. And I found a 1963 Peace Officers magazine, and in the Williston Police Department section, there's this young sergeant named Stan Leeson, so I think the law enforcement guys in this room at least are interested in taking a look at that.
You wouldn't even board that.
So anyway. Stan was more attractive back in those days. But if I may, I want to get right to the two projects that I'd like to discuss with you today. I think Amy and Kevin has already, they both have already discussed who we are and what we do. And if I could roll you down to the proposal dealing with Indian Country. This program, what we're, in a nutshell, as an introduction, trying to do is divert Indian people from coming from the tribal system and rolling up into the state system or the federal system. And so we envision having a having tribally sentenced people coming into the Bismarck Transition Center on an inpatient status. These would be correctional residents. We plan on serving about 30 of these folks. We would transport these people back and forth from their home reservations. We deliver an assessment project to them, assessment program, I should say, to them, very similar to what we do with the Department of Corrections. That might take as much as 60 days. We don't expect that, but we're guessing it could take that long. We'd look through all the materials that we got from the tribe, any other assessment tools. We'd develop some of our own assessment tools. And then staff from the Bismarck Transition Center, as well as the tribes, would work together and make a recommendation back to the tribal court. Pursuant to that tribal court's order, a resident could then come to the BTC for up to 180 days. And during that time, they'd be delivered very programming that's varied, but on average, pretty similar to what we also deliver to some of our other folks that are there from the Department of Corrections and other places. After they'd be released, we'd try to help the tribes with reentry back on the reservation. So that's kind of really brief, and I apologize for that, but it's a really brief description of what we try to do with these folks.
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Triplett. I'm sorry, Trimbeth. You guys come from the same area, though.
We used to have the Senate law firm of Trainer, Trimbeth, and Triplett.
Mr. Emmer, I just, it crossed my mind, so I thought I'd ask while I had you here. Is this, this methodology with respect to this interrelationship with tribes, is that something that's being done now in your Montana operations?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Trinbad, and it is a little difficult to say that in a group like this, but no, we haven't really attempted this before. This may be, as we look through this, I think relatively innovative from the standpoint that what we're trying to do, and I'll just brief it, and you'll have these bullet points, and maybe my presentation will be nearly over on this part of it, is we're envisioning a system where the tribes would work together, join a cooperative, and work through that cooperative, and then deliver residents to our facility as part of a cooperative. The advantages to that is we've got a relationship now with Mr. Patry. He's a executive director of the Common Enterprise Development Corporation, and they're very skilled in putting together such cooperatives, and they also are quite skilled in finding the money to run those cooperatives. And so what we're trying to do, and it's important to note, we're not looking for any state money to do anything with this. What we're trying to do is generate the interest at the reservation level with the tribal councils and the tribal courts and the tribal probation officers and Indian Health Services. We have lots of interest, and no one knows, quite frankly, where to go next. And so what we're trying to do, and I want to give this information to this committee, is get these folks together and motivate them to join a cooperative and then have a board of directors made up of all the member reservations, possibly one or two from each reservation, the tribal chair, we're guessing, and maybe the tribal judge, and they'd be voting members on a cooperative, and then we'd look for alternative funding through that source.
So this is, Mr. Chairman, if I might, this is something that your operation here is modeling. It hasn't been modeled elsewhere, and then it's being brought in.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Trinbeth, that's right. We're trying, you know, it's, somebody said once, maybe we're trying to build sandcastles. I don't know, but we're trying to get the reservations, or at least some of the reservations, to work together, and then have those folks then join as a cooperative and make application for various other funds that may be available out there. One of the perhaps unknown things that's happening in Indian country, and I think a lot of people here are aware of it, is the BIA is, a lot of their funding is drying up. A lot of their jailing dollars have dropped. And so the BIA is, whatever we would call capacity in a tribal jail, it's being met. I mean, they're full. And so all we have to, it's as simple as this, is I can pick up the phone and call a tribal judge and ask them if they'd have any interest in this, and they're all over it. They're looking for alternatives. I've talked to the U.S. attorney and Tim Purden, and he's interested in this as well. So that's, you know, I'm run through my presentation on Indian country proposal, maybe a little less formal than I should, but that in a nutshell is what we're looking at. We think that it could avoid some folks from getting into the federal system, and I think it could avoid some folks from getting into the state system. And that's why I thought it was important, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, for us to present here today to give you a sense of what that is.
Mrs. Olson, please.
Yes, Mr. Emmer, I was just wondering, Arthur mentioned that in the BTC here in Bismarck, they do a lot with your folks in the area of work release and jobs, opportunity, and so on and so forth. Are you primarily focusing on on the substance abuse and the counseling that you're doing with the tribal members? Are you also going to be kind of focusing on job availability? Because I know that that's one of the biggest areas of need on the reservation lands, and so I'm just wondering how far you're going to take this. I know that the counseling and the need for substance abuse was really there. I mean, I know this, and everybody knows this, but I'm wondering about the opportunity for employment, how far you're going to get into that, and what your thoughts are on that.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Olson, we're going to take this as far as we can get the comfort level of the tribal leadership to take it. They would prefer for us to have a, almost a post-transition, if you will, back onto the reservation. That's going to require us to seek out additional money, and Mr. Patry and I've looked at some grant opportunities where we could have either renovate or build from new small, safe transitional facilities there at home, where then if there's any work availability, they could start from there, and it's in a clean and sober environment and a safe environment. This would, one group that we looked at as a pilot has to do with women that are coming through tribal systems, and they've been charged with tribal offenses, and they're very drug addicted, and they're also pregnant. Now, this seems to be such a small number, but it really isn't. Mm-hmm. It really isn't. And so some of the tribal courts are saying, we'd love to have them in this program, but then when they're transitioning, have them in a safe transitional facility at home. We all know, and we need to be realistic, that there isn't much work when people get back to the reservations. So one of the things, and we'll have to seek some guidance from this group of tribal people once we assemble them, is if we start allowing tribal members to seek out work and participate in a work release program here in Bismarck, the likelihood is that they'd stay here. And that may be good, that may be bad, but I think most reservation folks would tell you that if these people can then start working, it's going to be much better, that they're going to do better, even if that means they have to leave the reservation to find the work. We've got a number of other ideas, some, I think, creative ideas, where if we could partner and get some people some basic renovation skills, for example, for housing, and they could then deliver that, go back home and become a fix-it person, if you will, at home, where they could help other people fix up their properties. But long story short, that's a tough uphill battle, getting back on the reservation and getting people employed. But that's the long-range goal, is that if we could figure out how to do that, that would be part of what we're interested in doing. Any other questions on this project?
Any further questions? If not,
I have one more thing I want to talk to you about, Mr. Chairman.
Speed it up.
I will. You used to boss me around before when you're... Okay, that's a story for a different... Anyway, the Bismarck Transition Center went through some rough spots a couple years ago. And we recognized through that time, I was already a part-time guy, but I was doing some other things, that we needed to get some good advice from a lot of local people. To help us become more professional. And that's just the long and short of it. So what we did is put together a strong Bismarck Transition Advisory Board. And I want to show you who's on that board, and then I think I'll just close out our presentation today, Mr. Chairman. Kevin Arthod, you've met him. He's the administrator for Bismarck Transition Center. Senator Dick Deaver, Colby Braun from the Department of Corrections, Chief Witt, and I know Keith is retiring, but we're hoping that his the new chief will assume that. Mike Wetch, who's an instructor at Rasmussen College. Sheriff Pat Heinert, and Pat and the chief have been both very outspoken on things that they thought we needed to do to improve how we do things at the Bismarck Transition Center. Shelley Paul from the Department of Human Services. Tim Fowler from the North Dakota State University. Tammy Kelsch from the United Tribes. Brenda Sather from Community Action, and then myself as a member. So we know what we needed to improve how we do business, and I think we've got a strong, competent board. And so that's our presentation today, Mr. Chairman, and I'd entertain any other questions if there are any.
Is there any further questions? Ms. Birch.
I have one question. The one concern, and being a big agency, this happens. I know none of your proposal with the tribes has anything, and you said it, we're not seeking state money. The concern is you talk about starting programs, whether it's on the tribes or elsewhere, with grant funding, and when those grant dollars dry up, you know where they come asking for the dollars. And I'm concerned that if you don't have an action plan that has a sustainability that the tribes pay for it, I find some extra line items in my budget when we're trying to shrink the corrections budget.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman Ms. Birch, I can understand your concern. Keep in mind that what we're looking at are tribally sentenced people under the jurisdiction of the tribes. For them to even receive any of these grant dollars, they're going to have a sustainability plan. The sustainability plan that we're going to develop is through the Common Enterprise Development Corporation. And we'll let you take a look at our work product as we go along. So, thanks.
Thank you. Keep us informed.
Thanks.
Okay, now we can go to our 11:30. We're doing pretty well, aren't we? So, is Martin County people here? You're up and you're ready to go?
I'm up and ready to go.
Fire away.
I'm Lois Scharnhorst. I'm the clerk of court in Martin County. And I was asked to come and just talk a little bit about the collection of restitution by the clerks of court in North Dakota. I did a brief survey. I found out that the three largest counties are really the only ones who do not collect restitution in the state. That would be Cass County, Burley County, and Grand Forks. And right now, Cass County has started collecting the restitution and keeping track of it, and then once a week sending a check to the state's attorney's office, and they send it out to the victims. They're doing that evidently because the judges wanted access to what was going on with the restitution in the case file. So they started that about 2 to 3 months ago. Pretty much all of the smaller counties, and Martin County included, we collect the restitution and we send it out. And it is, you know, somewhat of a burden to our office. But by the same token, a lot of the smaller counties, like Martin County, we probably could do it, but like, Ransom County, Sargent County, Sioux County, counties like that, they're lucky if they have a full-time state's attorney, and they just don't have the resources in that, in the state's attorney's office, to really collect the restitution. So the clerks are doing it. Right now we have a new Odyssey program, which really has made it easy for us to track the payments. We get the restitution payments in, and we link them to the defendant, and we link them to the file, and we get the payments. We're already collecting like fines and fees and administrative costs, and so the restitution is just kind of added in there. Odyssey automatically puts everything where it should be. We have the ability in Odyssey to assess, suspend, waive, and monitor it. When somebody's not paying, we bring them into court, and the judge can see everything that's going on in the file, which they like. So Odyssey has helped a lot with the burden. Some of the people who are owed money do call us and seem to think that we are their private collection agency, which can be somewhat irritating at times. I'm not sure what exactly you were thinking about doing with the restitution, if there was some idea that you had of implementing it a statewide office to collect restitution, or having them do it more
we like thought maybe civilly. You would help us with that.
Pardon?
We thought maybe you would give us some suggestions.
In our office, what I would like more than the restitution doesn't seem to be, you know, that much of a burden, since we're already kind of monitoring everything else, and Odyssey is such a great system to put the victim names in and to just have the checks go out. It isn't overly burdensome, I don't think.
Can you give us some kind of a percentage that you're collecting?
Actually, I did look at that and printed the report, the Odyssey report, right now, I don't know that it was really accurate, so I didn't bring that. Every county would vary so much. I mean, the small counties would have such a small amount. Morton would have more. Burley, you know, the bigger counties would have so much more.
I understand. I'm looking at, what percentage do you collect from these people? Are they, are all of them in there, are they arrear, or are most of them up to date in the payment plan programs, or?
We do try to keep them up to date lately. We did, after moving to Odyssey, they have been having trouble with our reports and able to track everything together, which I'm on a committee today, actually, where we're working on, in Odyssey, getting all the fines and fees and restitution for one defendant to all track together, so we can track everything together and bring them in easier on order to show causes. So typically, we do pretty good with collections. Lately, not so good, because the system just isn't set up quite properly yet, but we're working on it. Typically, if they're not paying, we bring them in on an order to show cause, and basically, if they can't pay or have no money, it's really difficult to get the money, but if they have it, we do everything in our power to get it. You know, areas that would help us maybe more than even collection of restitution would be in child support cases, which is totally off the track, but we monitor child support, and we have the regional child support enforcement agencies, and it would seem appropriate that they would take over all of the child support instead of having, you know, clerk-only cases where the clerks are monitoring the child support and monitoring the order to show causes, and then they're monitoring some of them. They're really the experts in child support and can set up the payment plans, because we do send people to jail for non-payment of child support. That would be one area that would be really helpful for us to save time and effort in the clerk of court's office. And traffic tickets, we collect all the money for the traffic tickets too, and I was thinking that maybe if there was a central office or agency that would, you know, all the highway patrol and all the tickets would go to, that would be really helpful. But right now, each county is doing their own. And also, right now we have the ability to have people get fines and fees and traffic tickets. They could pay online through Odyssey. It would be nice if somehow we could figure out how to get that information out there to people so that they could more readily pay their fines and fees online instead of sending us checks or calling the clerk of court's office to pay. They could just go online and pay it, and it would be done. But
is that something you're working through Odyssey to do?
It's pretty much implemented that Odyssey does have the capability of taking the payments online. I have tried putting on all of, like, our tickets, the website that they can go to pay, like, just manually put little...
How many counties are on Odyssey, do you know?
The whole state is on Odyssey.
The whole state is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's a good program. Paperless. It was called paperless. Now we call it paper on demand.
Close.
I don't know if I was very helpful with the restitution issue. It's kind of complicated as far as the smaller counties having.
Well, I guess I was looking at just say Morton County, and you have Mr. X that is charged and has to pay restitution of $5,000 to whoever. What percentage of that, when you set up a program for him to pay so much a month, what percentage of these people are keeping that current?
Well, I had printouts. I should have brought them along. I was actually sick and still am getting over a cold. So I didn't bring them along. So I don't have the exact percentages, unfortunately.
Do you guess? Is it close to being...
I'm sure that a great percentage were in the rear.
Yeah, we do have quite a few in arrears, and then we have quite a few who are making diligent, regular payments every single month. One person is making $5 payments every month, another person making $300 payments every month, and they're very diligent. Then some people aren't making any of their payments. And in Odyssey, when they make the $5 payments every month, we can set it up now to where, okay, they're only making $5 payments. We're not going to send restitution out of $5 every month, every month, every month. We can wait until it's up to $50 and send out one check. So that does make it a little easier.
Anybody else have any questions? If not, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Is there anybody else here to testify on this, on the clerk court's problem or her programs? If not, we'll close that portion of it, and we're into looking at 11:40. Is there anybody here that's going to be testifying on that, or do we know anything on it?
No.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Al Austin. I represent the work for the North Dakota Association for Justice, and our members primarily are trial lawyers. In addition, we have members who are state's attorneys, part-time state's attorneys, and we have members who are criminal defense attorneys. Both of those two groups within our association believe that the numbers need should be adjusted. Now, especially if you talk to those who are in the western part of North Dakota, where we have states, part-time state attorneys, which are facing a 400% increase in their workload. Their feeling is that some of these should be adjusted rather than making them felonies at this point. A lot of them aren't being prosecuted in felonies, even though they probably ought to be. They simply don't have time. It's time consuming what the adjustment should be. I know there was a proposal in front of the Interim Judiciary Committee 2 years ago, and rather needed to go that in depth. But it's time, I think. Some of these are unchanged for the last 40 years. They have not changed. In the early 70s, many of these limits were established. For a $51 check, as an example, that's a felony that bounces in, and maybe they need to be adjusted. I think it's something that needs to be looked at again, and I know that Justice Merring has brought it up in the last instance, and we agree with that. We think it does need to be studied and looked at. It may be easier to let our guys, both prosecutors in the West and in other areas where that kind of crime rates are growing up, gives them adjusted time in it. You don't want to say that to work on the more serious crimes, because if you've been robbed of something, it's a serious crime of what it are, but more maybe have more time devoted to those crimes that actually impact and can charge, cause harm to people rather than just property, and that might be something that needs to be looked at. That's the only comments we have at this point.
Sheriff.
Mr. Chairman,
Al Austin with the...
What types of crimes are you looking at?
Well, I think you'd want to look at all of those who have monetary limits that move them from a misdemeanor to a felony. And there was like a 9-page bill draft that maybe John could get you that was done, that was looked at the last legislative interim. And it was like, I think it was 8 or 9 pages, I don't, you know. And I think you should look at all of them, perhaps. Again, you know, if there was a monetary limit that was $50 to become a felony in 1970, maybe it ought to be adjusted somewhat. You know, and that's... Those limits all need to be, I think, discussed, and what specific dollar numbers they are, you know, that's part of the discussion, but they should probably be adjusted.
Are you talking about certain theft offenses?
Theft, deceptance, shoplifting.
The system at this point is, you know, $500 is pretty substantial for a lot of people to be taken from. So I'm just, I was wondering where the threshold is and what monetary, I think a $50 expense currently would be a fee misdemeanor, correct?
Well, I think if I remember looking at it yesterday, if it's a check, $50 is a misdemeanor, $51 is a felony. And what the levels are, I'm not here to suggest at this point, but it's something that I think should be looked at.
I guess I'm struggling with that because I don't think a $51 check is a felony, but that's why I'm wondering what's at. I'm trying to challenge you here.
Mr. Chairman,
it's Class B. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it is. That.
Again, it goes back to monetary values that are already set by the state. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
But again, I'm not ready to get into specifics at this time, but I think it's time again to look at these to see if there are some. Again, if something was established, a monetary limit in 1970, maybe it needs to be looked at. If it doesn't, if everything's fine, then I don't see the rationale.
Mr. Chairman, would your organization also be open to the idea of looking at traffic fines and all along that goes along with that as well?
Well, if they move them, I don't know why you wouldn't want to look at all of those types of items. If they're 30, 40, 50 years old, when those monetary limits were established, yeah, they probably all ought to be to study to see if it's still appropriate to today.
Thank you, sir.
Judge?
Mr. Chairman, my recollection from the last meeting was this was brought up by Justice Mehring. And I think part of her concern was mostly with the $500 felony level, that might be too low. When you think about all the things that go into prosecuting a felony, the expense for the prosecutor and the judicial system and all the additional appearances. So that was the one that I think she was mostly interested in, was that perhaps the $500 threshold for a C felony was too low. I don't think she made any recommendation or suggestion even of what the amount should be, but just that it be revisited. That's my recollection from the last meeting.
And I think you're right.
And that's our point, too. Maybe they need to be looked at again. All of them, that's up for debate. I wouldn't suggest that at this point.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think, Judge, you're right that Justice Marion was considering the $500 thing was what she was really looking at there I think she was thinking about it should be higher for a felony than $500, and I don't know what she was looking at. I think we can. What we'll do is, because she couldn't be here today, that just to leave it at that and put it on the agenda for the next meeting, and she can bring it up there. One of the problems that I have with moving $500 to a misdemeanor compared to a felony is that $500 is a heck of a lot of money to some people, and they want them people prosecuted more than, and it probably hurt those people more than stealing from other people for $1,000. So where do we set the limit at? But I think, why don't we leave this till Justice Marion is back and talk about that. Anybody? Oh, Ms. Birch.
Chairman Leeson, there was reference to a bill draft that was brought forward, a 9-page, and I think that's probably looked at all of those thresholds, because there's a lot of them throughout the Century Code, whether it's misapplication of entrusted funds, the theft.
Well, I've been in the Senate for a little over 12 years now, and we did change some of those during that time. I can't remember when we did it, but we did raise it during that time. So
right, and I'm just saying, I think there was a bill draft out of that interim study. If we could look at that bill drafts, because it has all of them there for the next meeting, and at a minimum, I agree, thefts should be prosecuted. But I think it's time to probably come into line with the inflation of what happens over 40 years with, certainly it's a lot easier to steal $500 than probably in 1973. It took a lot more to steal $500, at a bare minimum, to look at the federal levels. And I think it's probably $1,000 to get to a felony in the federal system. Now, that doesn't mean crimes go unpunished. A crime for most people, whether it's A misdemeanor or B misdemeanor, has a major impact on their lives. If they have any life at all, it impacts their life. And certainly, if it's your first time offense, whether it's a felony or not, you're probably going to walk away with a deferred or suspended sentence. The difference is the resources that go into prosecuting that case. You'll probably have the same result. You'll probably get all the restitution if it's a fairly pro-social person that had a run-in with the law. And the other thing is anyone that's sentenced to felony probation, whether it's deferred or suspended, then becomes on the Department of Corrections probation caseload. And a lot of times, those people don't need an officer supervising them. They need kind of a collection agency type of person saying, pay your money up and we'll be done with this. So I think, you know, I'm not saying, yeah, I think all theft should be prosecuted and they should be held accountable. It's just at what level and at what level of resources do we need to go after them?
Is there somebody else who would like to speak on this, Bill?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Travis Fink. I'm an attorney at the Bismarck Public Defender's Office. I'm actually a supervising attorney there. I'm also a member of the North Dakota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. However, today I'm speaking to you simply as a criminal defense attorney after speaking with Mr. Bjornson. In discussions with other members of the criminal defense bar and of members of state's attorney's offices across the state, I think the levels do need to be looked at. There does need to be some sort of amendment. Director Birch made a comment as to the resources that would be used. Specifically from the public defense side of it, when we look at the resources attributed to a felony versus a misdemeanor, there's a significant difference there. We have, with a felony, obviously you have the right to a preliminary hearing. And then things go on from there where officers are coming off the street to testify about an iPhone that was taken from Walmart. I think the last time, and I have a version of that bill, if anyone wants to look at it specifically today, that was passed around the last legislative session. I did bring that with. Specifically, what they had tried at that time was to amend it to $1,000. And I, like Mr. Austin, I don't know the exact number. I imagine that'll be something that would have to be hammered out through the legislative process, but I do think they need to be looked at. I believe the last time the specific felony amount was looked at was 1986, I believe, or somewhere in the mid-80s is the last time that was looked at. Obviously, that was before, what we see a lot in my office anyways, is technology-related thefts, things of that nature. If someone walks out with an iPhone, that's a felony-level offense. Whereas before, we didn't really have those types of things where I see a lot of 18, 19-year-old kids who think it's cool to have the latest gaming system. So they take a gaming system from a buddy. Well, that gets reported as a theft of property. The new gaming systems are over $500. We've now got a felony. They have a preliminary hearing. Officers have to come off the street and testify at the courts. Plus, the courts spend a lot more time dealing with the felonies than we do. If they get the deferred sentences so they have the opportunity to keep this off their record, it has to be supervised probation the way the statutes are written. So then Department of Corrections has to, I won't say waste, but use up resources on someone who probably doesn't need it when we have a lot more violent and dangerous offenders out there that we could be supervising than an 18, 19-year-old kid who stole his buddy's video game system. So just real briefly, I wanted to comment that I do believe the amounts need to be raised. As I believe there was a comment earlier too about the western part of the state, I can say, looking at the attorneys in my office, our numbers have gone up exponentially in the last 2 years, and the number of felonies has gone up because there's just more people. As there's more people, there's going to be more interaction amongst people, which leads to more crime and also more violent crime. So I think those numbers will only continue to go up.
And I know there's a big concern, at least one of the concerns I was floating around in the legislative session was getting the restitution repaid and getting that done in a timely manner. I would argue, or at least submit to the commission to consider, that if it's a misdemeanor, it's more likely to be repaid in a quicker fashion than if it's a felony. Because when you're on supervised probation, you have $45 a month that you have to pay to Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation to be on supervised probation. If that's not a supervised probation, that's $45 a month that could be going towards restitution. Also with misdemeanors, there's provisions for misdemeanor compromise where it can come completely off the record if they're able to pay that restitution upfront, so the victim gets reimbursed before we even have to deal with it in a court trial type of situation. So I just think there's so many more benefits to all the parties involved, the state, the defense, and the victims in the case, if it would be a misdemeanor versus a felony. Again, I don't know the magic number. I don't pretend to know the magic number, but I do think they should at least be looked at and serious consideration given to all of the resources that go into a felony versus a misdemeanor. And with that, I just wanted to make a comment on behalf of what I'm seeing, I guess, in the criminal defense bar, and I would make myself available to any questions if there were any.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Glassheim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your interesting, broad remarks on this. I wonder if you or the organization wouldn't take a few things and hazard a recommendation. I mean, we don't know either. There is no magic number. It's just, but if you thought $1,000, in whatever categories you thought might make sense, I think it would help us in our deliberations if you had some recommendation.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Glassheim, to respond to that, when Mr. Bjornson sent out to the Association for Criminal Defense Lawyers that this was going to be going on and asking if someone would come and at least give a broad speak, and again, I don't speak for the organization, but there was several emails that have been floating around, and I'm not even sure we have a firm number within our group, but definitely one thing I could do would be to go back to them and say, you know, there is some interest at taking a sincere look at this and maybe have us come up with a firm number. I will pass that along.
Senator Triplett.
Mr. Chairman, I don't recall exactly, but I think at our last meeting, someone, and maybe it was Justice Mehring, was suggesting that even if you just do a simple, you know, inflation consideration and consider current values compared to valuations 40 years ago or whatever, that we'd be at least at the $2,000 level. So maybe we could ask our esteemed counsel to actually just get that number for next time, just what basic inflation would do for it. I mean, I think it's a good idea, as the current speaker is saying, to take into consideration the fact that, you know, that lots of highly desirable electronics are of a particular value, and I think those are good things too. But I think at an absolute minimum, the place to start is, you know, what inflation has done to $500 since it was in place. Thanks.
Any further questions? If not, thank you very much for coming in. Anybody else have any comments on this subject? Any board members? If not, we'll put it on the agenda for the next session, and we'll get some of the information and statistics made up so that we know where we're setting and see what we can do next time. All right. Is there anything else that should be brought in front of this group?
Mr. Chairman.
Judge.
I just have a question for Mr. Bjornson. Who is inquired of for information on that? Were the state's attorney's office or association included on that, or who was included in the inquiry?
Mr. Chairman, Judge, I don't recall. Yes, I did. I talked to Rod Erickson, state's attorney, McLean County, to get suggestions as to who would be interested in addressing this. Ladd was unavailable today, but I had suggested a couple names to me that I contacted, and that's how I got to Mr. Fink ultimately, and a few other attorneys that weren't able to make it to today's meeting.
Maybe we can get some here next time, huh? You can talk some of your state's attorneys. Anything else should come from the group? If not, we're out of here.
I'll email that bill draft to everybody, just...
Say what?
I'll email that bill draft from last time.